Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Many healthcare workers risk their physical and mental health to do their jobs. The coronavirus pandemic has intensified these challenges. Healthcare workers are on the front lines treating COVID-19 patients, trying to help people survive and witnessing these traumatic events. Research has found that just observing these kinds of events can be psychologically similar to experiencing them yourself. Clinical psychologist Dr. Chad Wetterneck says the medical community needs to pay greater attention to their employees and look out for symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. He says that proper support and coping tools are especially important in light of the pandemic. Dr. Wetterneck joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. She begins by asking how the medical community would have typically dealt with employee PTSD before the pandemic.
I think that probably varies greatly based on each location and how much they emphasize this. I would hope that they at least have some rudimentary, if you get exposed to very stressful events, you're likely to take on some of that stress. It's probably more common for people to get a debriefing after something major happens. So potentially maybe a loss of life that wasn't expected in their unit or something else that's pretty bad happening, for people to come in and do a debriefing on things that could happen as a result. But I think by and large, we probably do not have as much of a focus on having them understand what PTSD is and how they could contract it from their job.
So let's get into that a little bit. How is PTSD looking in the medical frontline community?
Yeah, and if I could just take that a little bit more broad, you know, most people when they hear post-traumatic stress disorder, they think of, you know, people that have been involved in combat and military situations. So there's a lot of, you know, people know that veterans are likely to encounter this and develop symptoms, but other types of traumas are just as likely to result in development of PTSD symptoms, things like motor vehicle accidents, near-death situations, physical assaults, sexual assaults, any sort of natural disaster, whether it's a hurricane, tornado in our area, or something else like an explosion, whether it's person-made or not. So someone has to encounter something that they felt like either their life or the life of someone around them was compromised to the point of where they could have lost their life. People generally feel really helpless and afraid. They have a limbic system response where they either want to fight, flight, or actually freeze, where they don't do anything at all. And then in our medical centers, they're likely to see, especially if they work in, let's say, like a trauma unit or even in the ER or something like that, you're going to get people who probably had something like that happen to them. You're seeing the after effects of this. So they're going to be exposed to like the aftermath of a trauma. And people could also develop symptoms just by seeing the aftermath of a trauma as well.
Obviously, change in mood and thoughts can look different in everyone, but in a work environment that's so stressful and high risk, such as a hospital ICU right now or a COVID floor, you know, how can things like this not simply be brushed off or attributed to how people are acting just during that shift? Because it goes beyond that.
Sure. And I think we have to realize a few things. So I'm talking about some of the worst case scenarios here. And I also want to mention that most people who experience a trauma do not go on and develop PTSD. So they don't have all the symptoms, or if they do have some symptoms, they can be temporary because of course it was scary or potentially a loss of life where there's some grief involved. And sometimes the activities they do after that or time heal some of those kind of like psychological wounds. So I don't want to make it sound like everyone's going to develop this. This is actually, you know, more the exception than the norm. And going back a little bit more to your question, people probably need to adjust to more stressful times and will look different than what their baseline is for their mood and behavior. And we have to accept that as a potential normal response. And that in this time, maybe what we need to do is be even more, while I'm doing my job, still be grounded and detached from the actual stress of it. What we need to be able to recognize is whether or not that's now carrying over into their home life, or if they are, you know, in down periods of time at work, if there are such things, are they still different than what their baseline is, where they appear much more distant, much more kind of like pessimistic about things, Maybe it's they don't do things that they relied upon before for coping skills. You know, some people might take a walk during lunch and they're no longer doing that. They're no longer communicating with their peers quite as much. So some of this is a normal response, but we have to see how much it generalizes to all areas of what they do.
So it's kind of a little difference between using tools for desensitizing yourself as a way to get through things versus taking that to the next level of, would you say, feeling numb?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's one way to look at it. And I think we're trying to look and see whether or not are people trying to stay in kind of a protective mode all the time, or are they still willing to not only do things for themselves, but share things that could be a little bit more vulnerable to them so that they can actually kind of process some of the things that they're experiencing, which also then lets other people know, hey, I need support. And then you're more likely to get that support when you're willing to share those things.
You know, there's a saying that doctors are some of the worst patients. So how important is it to seek help and to encourage them seeking help and monitor not just themselves, but each other during this time?
I think it's really important. I don't think we can state that enough. And I've heard that saying many times before as well. And I think, you know, we're dealing with some stigmas here that I think there's a general stigma of mental health that comes up where, depending on how you were raised in your environment, whether it supported talking about feelings or emotions or reaching out for help, that's one element of it. And then there's this, this phenomena of medical and mental health providers, you know, being viewed as, well, you know about how to stay healthy, whether it be physical or mental health. And I think that actually, they'll hear that from people. You know, if they ask someone for help, they might be met with, oh, but you're the doctor, or you're a therapist, or you're someone that, you know, don't you know this stuff? And of course, that's not really reinforcing for them. And they also might develop this own sense of, yeah, aren't I supposed to know this? Am I supposed to present with an aura of kind of like confidence and being an expert here? And sometimes, again, that generalizes to an unhealthy effect, to where they, you know, they might be willing to sit with symptoms longer than they should or not get them addressed at all.
The worst example that we have seen is the ICU nurse in New York that committed suicide. So obviously there's, as you mentioned, there's a big spectrum here with how people are being affected and dealing with it. So how is mental health treatment adapting to meet this need? You know, speaking specifically to Wisconsin area healthcare workers and mental health care providers, you know, how is that extra outreach being accomplished? And obviously there's a greater need for it, but do you see that need being expressed like it should be?
Well, I think in some places they're starting to meet the needs, and in other areas they could definitely do more work. When I look at things on a system level versus more like a national level, each organization I think has an obligation to try to improve things where they're making sure they're hearing their employees, what are their current concerns, and also is their organization listening to like the local and national experts on what should we be doing to take care of ourselves? Are they protecting them in some way, especially in hospital settings? Are they using personal protective equipment? Do they have access to that? Do people have worries about whether or not they're going to have access to that? Do they feel like they have the preparation or training for this as well? What do they need to know to still do their job effectively? And then it's like the support piece. And I think that's the one that, you know, we want to be as helpful as possible, but there's sometimes these boundaries between how much are we infringing on someone's personal life and their thoughts and their, you know, mental health in our work environments. And I think people feel like they have to kind of like balance that. I mean, everyone wants healthy employees, but they don't want to make someone have to get help or talk about these things because it probably violates some privacy laws and other things in organizations. What I see on like a larger level is I see a lot of more national organizations trying to offer seminars, webinars, trying to get people to understand how it affects them, sometimes very broadly, sometimes more specific in specific roles that they're in. I know that in the organization that I work in, one thing that we've done, we've set up things like, smaller self-care sessions where we can just talk openly about things with the purpose being not to vent about what's wrong, but more to be able to hear each other, but give support, help problem solve certain things. be able to point out what we still are in control of. I mean, when we're in this challenging environment, we need to be able to focus on what is actually under our control. We're not going to ignore the other things, but if we over-focus on those uncontrollables, that's going to lead us to feel helpless. I don't know that case fully about the person that took their own life, but typically when those situations arise, it's because people feel like, I don't know how else to try to solve what's going on right now. I feel helpless. I don't see hope. And in those situations, we want to let people know there are some things that people can still do to try to have control within their job and also what they do when they go home.
So what do you see as the long-term impact on these workers way down the line after we manage to control the pandemic and eventually have a vaccine and these measures aren't necessary? But how is this period of time, for however long it lasts, going to impact these workers as they carry on?
I think that's going to greatly depend on how they are trying to work through what's going on right now. And I think we have to consider that even if some states or certain areas are saying, you know, we can go back to normal times fairly soon, I think in our minds, we realize that it could be much longer than that. And it would be more healthy for us to think, not that things are going to go back to normal anytime soon, but that I need to try to bring aspects of what was coping for me before this happened into my current day-to-day regimen and routine, because I don't know when this could end. So I'm not going to just wait for it to end to go back to doing things that were even more healthy for me. If they don't do that, I do think that the long-term impact is when people get stressed, they not only develop some mental health issues, they're more likely to have wear and tear on their body. Their cortisol levels are going to be high in stressful situations. And once a situation passes, but you've had a long time of that cortisol level activation, that's when you're actually more susceptible to getting sick, to feeling down. And we don't know how long this is going to last, where they have to keep that kind of like stress response going. So those that are able to implement a more healthy regimen are more likely to come out of this kind of being able to have the perspective of, I developed some resiliency. That was incredibly challenging, but I made it through, and I hope it doesn't happen again. And those that don't adapt are the ones that are more likely to develop different physical and mental health conditions, and maybe even question if they want to be in this field.
With the workers who are in the, you know, the heat of COVID, and with hospital policies not allowing visitors, you know, they're surrounded by death and they have the additional task of being the only source of contact and comfort for patients and facilitating family connections with their personal phones, even for FaceTime and things like that. So that's a big additional weight that is affecting them.
Yeah, it is. And I think this comes under the people need training for this. So even in medical settings where people may end up dying, more times than not, there's probably some family that can be called, that can come on the scene, that maybe were already there because they know that there was either an accident or perhaps it was something that was expected to happen in the next couple of days. And they'll need more support than usual during those times. It'll be important for them to find a trusted, safe outlet for them to be able to talk about what happened. And I know, and this isn't really a stigma, but it's part of our job in both physical and mental health locations to still be confidential about what happened at our workplace. That doesn't mean we can't come home and tell a friend or significant other, I just had a really tough day and, you know, a patient lost their life, or I had to make a really, really difficult phone call or facilitate this message to someone. That's enough for another person that cares about you typically to understand and offer some support there. But I do think each organization needs to do what they can to try to prepare them for this either happening or happening more often than it has in the past.
You mentioned some tips for personal coping and well-being. So expanding upon that, what would you recommend that organizations do for these workers?
Well, and you know, without telling people exactly what to do, they could still have emails and reminders and signs up about making sure, first of all, they're taking care of their basic needs. So, you know, I often use this reference that not a lot of people know, but Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which, you know, kind of talks about what do people need to function. And on a very basic level, people need things to eat, they need things to drink, they need sleep. So to be able to emphasize that even in a really stressful job, you know, when people get caught up and they're either actively saving life or otherwise, I mean, maybe 6 hours pass and they realize, oh yeah, lunch was 3 hours ago, but I was kind of occupied. It's making sure that they're instructing their employees to still do things that give them that physical health aspect of basic needs. And then there's a lot of emotional needs that we need to try to promote. And I think it's fair for our organizations to say, we want you to do things that will actually be able to get you in touch with periods of calm in your life. Another thing I'd recommend is, you know, having them ask, what did they used to do to try to deal with stress and anxiety, or even to improve their mood? What were their previous coping skills? And I think having lists of things that people frequently do for coping skills would be really helpful. You know, obviously sleeping would be helpful, but stretching, walking, doing yoga, just taking some time to rest, engaging in things that involve like showing compassion for yourself and other people. Part of that could be just recognizing all of this stress and emotional reaction you're having. It's normal. This is a higher stress time. There's nothing wrong with you that you're feeling this way. This is more challenging even for non-mental and physical health workers, because everyone's contemplating like death and sickness more than they would usually. So don't over-pathologize yourself. Don't assume that it means there's something wrong. Think about the people that you trust the most in your life. And this could be a very relative term, but talk to them. Tell them some of your fears and let them offer you some comfort. Now, that's not ever in everyone's wheelhouse, but if you can take steps toward that, it's going to be better than doing nothing at all.
All right. Well, Dr. Chad Wetternick, thank you so much for joining me today and talking about this very important topic.
All right. Thank you, Audrey. I like doing it, and I hope it's helpful for folks.
Dr. Chad Wetternick is a clinical psychologist and clinical director of trauma recovery services at Rogers Behavioral Health. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on WUWM.